We got a huge show today, and that's why we're leading off early. And no better than to lead off with Bill Jacobson, Cornell law professor extraordinaire, on something that broke yesterday, and we have covered it, regarding the student up there accused of posting anti-Semitic threats online and a plea of guilty in federal court. Here to discuss is William Jacobson. And always good to have a little bit of a tune in play of introduction there. I kid you. But, Bill, it's great having you here early as it is, but still somewhat monumental as far as what broke yesterday, my friend. Can you assess and discuss with us?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So back in late October, after October 7th, as unbelievable as it was, on campuses there were actually protests in support of what Hamas did, including at Cornell. And as part of that, in late October, there were threats posted on some chat room that I guess a lot of students use that were quite violent. Claims that this person didn't identify himself, was going to come to campus, slit throats of Jews, was going to shoot up the kosher dining hall. And those were kind of the milder of the threats. Behead people. I mean, it was very graphic, multiple. So it obviously set off a bit of a panic because you don't know what's real and what's not real. It's a real threat or it's not. And given that there were demonstrations on campus and given that there was anti-Israel graffiti on campus, people took it seriously, as they should. They did end up arresting somebody. The FBI did a very good job of tracking, however they track things on the internet, and found him, and he ended up being a Cornell student. So this was real. This was a junior. His name was Patrick Dye, D-A-I, from upstate New York. And he got arrested and charged. And yesterday he pleaded guilty in federal court in Syracuse, New York. Sentencing is going to be this summer.
So with Bill Jacobson on the plea from Patrick Dye, the student accused of posting all this anti-Semitic threats online, everything here. And it's appalling. It really is. And I guess it came out yesterday. We didn't know this at the time we covered it, that Patrick Dye is has been since diagnosed with autism, which I guess his lawyer will offer us some sort of context regarding his mental state, Bill. How effective will that be as far as the judge is concerned?
Well, really, since the beginning, his mother was talking about how he was all depressed and things like that. But let's face it, there are millions of people in this country who have autism or some form or some level of it, and they don't post these threats online. They don't threaten to, you know, to rape and slit the throats of Jewish women on campuses. So I don't think that's really a great excuse. It might be part of the picture. I assume the judge will take that into account, this count that he pleaded guilty to. So he's no longer just accused. He has pled guilty to it, carries up to a 5-year sentence. The feds say in the plea agreement that they are going to seek an enhancement to the sentencing guidelines based on this being a hate motivated crime. I think that's the term that the rules use. So I assume they'll ask for the full 5. I don't know that, but I think, you know, they're going to push for what they can, and the defense will come in and say, look, he was a depressed kid. He suffers from autism. Well, if he did suffer from autism, he was very high functioning. He was doing very well at Cornell until this. You know, he got into the school. He was a member of all sorts of clubs. So this is, you know, I don't know how far that's going to really get him to say that he had autism and therefore that's an excuse when he seems to have been fully functioning in all other aspects of his academic career. And so I don't know how far it will get, but obviously that's what the defense will do.
Yeah, Bill Jacobson with us, Cornell law professor. The event yesterday of the student, he's accused of posting anti-Semitic threats online. He pled guilty in the federal court, and he posted some very disturbing threats, ladies and gentlemen. You know, slitting the throats of Jewish males on campus, you know, beheading babies. I mean, it's just disgusting stuff here. And you make a good point. You know, those who have been diagnosed with autism, I don't know, I don't remember too many cases in this seat reporting on those with autism who have done some acts of violence, with said acts of violence and threats and everything else. I don't recall doing a lot of those stories. So that's that is an excellent point. And depending on sentencing and everything else, and we have seen these incidents in and around this country, Bill, what kind of a precedent do you think it could set here?
Well, I think if he were to get away with no serious jail time, that would be a horrible precedent. That would basically show students who are maybe not making quite as graphic threats as he did, but are making threats against Jews on campuses, that they can get away with it and there'll be no punishment. Obviously, we're seeing that in, you know, the New York City area with other sorts of crimes where people think they can get away with it and the judicial system would not, you know, impose any significant penalty. They do it again and again and again. So I think it would be terrible. I would personally be shocked if he doesn't get jail time. I mean, if he doesn't get, you know, 1, 2, 3 years in jail, let him get the help he needs there. Let him get the help he needs when he gets out. But I think there's a bigger question here, which you know, certainly Cornell does not want to address, which is, why did this kid, who, as far as we can tell, has no prior violent history, no prior history of these sort of threats, what turned his alleged mental illness or his alleged mental infirmities against Jews? What was it on our campus that radicalized Patrick Dow? And that, I think, is the question. And obviously, you know, it's clear to anybody looking at it, what radicalized him was the campus atmosphere, where the groups of students walking around with bullhorns calling for an intifada, which was is a violent uprising. Faculty, this was around the time, I can't remember if it was before or after, I think it was after, that professor on campus said he felt exhilarated by October 7th. So there was a toxic and continues to be a toxic atmosphere at Cornell regard when it comes to Israel. Doesn't mean the majority of people act like that or think like that, but there's a significant minority of the campus, including faculty, who hold the sort of belligerent views that radicalize people like Patrick Day or Dow, however it's pronounced.
No, that's an excellent point. You know, you think about Cornell, you think Ivy League, you think Harvard, and we all know what happened at Harvard and Claudine Gay and everything else with her testimony in Washington, an underlying type of situation, even more so. And, you know, I always remember reading about this guy, you know, who entered the school. You know, you talk about autism and everything else. I mean, let's face it, though. He's not a dummy. You know, he entered the school as one of five National Merit Scholars named at a high school, a 12-time AP scholar, also a long time volunteering at a hospital. You know, this is an individual who certainly had capabilities as far as elevating himself to the top of his class and future endeavors. And it's troubling. The underlying effect, you know, the stench, the aura that has taken place in and around this country at our most prestigious colleges and universities. And that, ladies and gentlemen, has to be thwarted out in some sort of way. And we saw this with Dye and Cornell. That's an excellent point. I bring up the whole Claudine Gay thing, Bill.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, what I think people need to focus on is not so much October 7th, obviously, that you do need to focus on that, but October 8th. How is it that the immediate reaction on campuses, and really almost peculiar to campuses, was to support what happened, was to blame the victims, was to, as Cornell professor said, contextualize what happened? What is so broken with our higher education system that the president of Cornell, in her first statement about October 7th, didn't even condemn Hamas's attack?
Yeah.
It was only after an absolute alumni uproar that she issued a second statement condemning the attack. So what is wrong with our campuses? A lot is wrong. It's called, you know, Cornell and other campuses have deep cultural problems where they encourage and where they tolerate not just hatred of Israel, but hatred of the United States. If you look at what these students are chanting, they hate the United States. They want to tear us down, too, not just Israel. But as historically is the case, Jews become the target.
No question. Bill Jacobson here, Cornell Law professor, the plea of guilty of Patrick Dye with the threats, anti-Semitism. And you know what's interesting? Just one other caveat regarding this, regarding some of these colleges, because, you know, we all read that they're going to engage maybe in training, you know, some of the faculty to the students reporting anti-Semitism. There was supposed to be some legislation proposed as these campuses have become a hotbed, as you and I both know, of anti-Israel activity here. What about the practices of a Cornell, for instance? You're there, that they would develop for reporting any incidents and making sure Bill, all these educators are trained, the students as well, on procedures. Has that started in any way?
Well, we've always had at Cornell, like many, if not most, colleges and universities, bias reporting system. There are mechanisms there, but I don't think anybody takes them very serious for instances like, you know, have been happening since October 7th, because a lot of the administrators felt the exhilaration that professor felt, and a lot of the faculty did also. There is an anti-Western culture and an anti-Western ideology that views the, what they would call decolonization as by any means necessary. That's the phrase they've been using, by any means necessary, as justified. You hear them going around, you know, when people are occupied, resistance is justified. You hear all those things. So there's a culture at Cornell that justifies violence if it's done in the name of, you know, indigenous liberation. But of course, that gives away the lie, because Israel is the single greatest example of indigenous liberation probably in history, where the indigenous people have reclaimed their land. But they don't consider that legitimate because those indigenous people happen to be Jews. You know, we know, you can tell in Israel who's indigenous and who's not, like who is in favor of archaeology to uncover the history and who is against it. And the Jews in Israel have very good archaeological programming, which often is the target of terrorists who don't want it to happen. What are you afraid of? If you really are indigenous, the people who identify as Palestinian Arabs, then you would welcome archaeology. You would welcome finding the proof that you were the first people there. But they don't. They fight it tooth and nail. So I think that there's a culture on campuses, and in fact, the primary group of students who are taunting others on campus name themselves the Coalition for Mutual Liberation. They should have called themselves the Coalition for Mutual Liberation, except for Jews.
Yeah. No doubt. And you know, again, most of these people don't even know the history as far as how it all began for Israel and everything else. 1948, Six-Day War, Yom Kippur War. Read about it. My goodness. Learn a little bit. Educate yourselves. They're so off base as far as what they have heard, especially, you know, I always remember you had a history professor there. His name escapes me. But, you know, this guy was on leave at the time. I don't know what happened to him since. Maybe you can update. I remember he called the attacks energizing, right? Exhilarating. You know, when you have individuals who are supposed to be frontline educators spew that type of venom. I mean, how else are students, some of these people absorb this information and take it to another level? That's the most alarming part of this as well. Top flight professors spewing this nonsense.
Yeah, and that professor happens to be very influential on campus among these student groups. He's back on campus, marching with them. He's still giving his talks, trying to portray Israel as a white colonial, white colonizers. So there is, you know, a core group of professors at Cornell. I don't know the exact number. I would guess probably 20 to 30 who spend almost all their time demonizing Israel, who spend almost all their time preaching this stuff. And 20 to 30 people on a campus can have a huge impact. Now, 20 to 30 is only a tiny percentage of the professors. I think most professors at Cornell would prefer just to stay out of this and teach their classes. But when you have activist professors, when you have professors who view bringing their political activism onto campus as part of their job, this is what you're going to get. And Cornell will not address that. I can tell you, Cornell will not address that.
Troubling as it is, and so many examples as far as what we have seen here, even prior to October 7th, by the way, folks, certainly accentuated after Israel was attacked. Well done. Good conversation. Still many need to be had in this regard, without question. Bill Jacobson, Cornell Law Professor. We'll be following this this case ongoing and see what happens here, Bill, and we'll bring you back. Can't thank you enough.
Great, thanks. Happy to come back.